You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello and welcome to the Bald Move Television Podcast. We are, of course, the officially unofficial podcast for literally all of television. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
And today we're going to be narrowing that focus down quite a bit to a single solitary episode of a excellent miniseries thus far, Chernobyl. We'll be giving full coverage to episode 2. Please remain calm. Hard to remain calm, Jim, when there's 3 billion trillion bullets firing all around. I've heard of bullet hell before, but this is ridiculous.
These are numbers that, like, Carl Sagan talks about in Cosmos when he's talking about the universal scale.
Yeah.
It's insane to hear these numbers. It almost doesn't mean anything.
Right.
When you say 3 billion trillion, or no, it's like 3 million grams putting off a billion trillion bullets each.
Right.
Like,
right.
What does that even mean?
I know. What does it mean when millions of those are streamed through your body?
It means you're dead, apparently. It means your
nothing
skin
good.
Burns, your helicopter crashes, and potentially 60 million people are displaced out of Eastern Europe because of radiation.
Yeah. It's interesting because we were pondering whether or not those men that were leading the doomed effort to open the floodgates to flood the reactor with water were actually going to do any good or not. We actually found out this week that they might doom the entire continent because opening those floodgates allowed these vast water tanks that should have been emptied to be flooded, and now we've got radioactive lava. Which is a thing that Jared Harris invents this episode that's going to come across this water in less than 48 hours and create what's called a thermal explosion from an expanse of the steam constrained in these big steel and concrete water tanks. It's going to blow up with a force between 2 and 4 kilotons, destroying the other remaining 3 reactors. And they mentioned just like all the countries affected, but they specifically said that Belarus and Ukraine would be uninhabitable for at least 100 million years, impacting 60 million people.
No, 100 years. You said 100 million.
You know, if you're a person alive, it might as well be 100 million.
Come on,
it's outside
Mr. Sagan.
Your lifetime.
Not everything could be on the universal
scale.
That's
true. That's true. For at least 100 years, and it's going to involve 60 million people. I honestly, that was shocking to me because I didn't know that the potential for harm was that high.
I didn't either. I assumed this would be a fairly isolated, you know, on this kind of scale, a fairly isolated incident.
Right.
Where, like, okay, the winds take it a few hundred kilometers in either direction and maybe into a couple surrounding countries. But to get to Germany, to get to, like, the point where you have school children in Frankfurt not being able to go outside.
Yeah. Like, essentially everything west of Chernobyl for, like, 1,000 miles is going to be a dead zone.
It seems like it, yeah.
You know, a couple lunches, because we have this segment for our club members, that we have lunch every Friday where we just get on camera and we talk about whatever people want us to talk about. And someone asked us about our thoughts on nuclear energy and how it could be used to, you know, help us stepstone away from fossil fuels on the road towards renewables. And I was kind of like more, hey, you know, I think the threats are overblown. And look at the worst disaster, Chernobyl. It wasn't that bad. And you were more like, you know, I've been thinking a lot and it seems like, woo, it's real dangerous. It's stuff like this that makes me think, I mean, I believe in science, I believe in scientists, but when they say something like this can never happen again, and when I'm seeing evidence from 30 years ago, the same scientist saying this shouldn't have been able to happen this time, and you're talking about destroying an entire continent, perhaps, for 100 years...
Yeah.
It's, I don't know, I would love some nuclear scientists to kind of write in and maybe assure us, or maybe it does seem like after something like this, I have to do a little bit more thought about being as pro-nuke as I am.
Yeah, I mean, my thing is, look, we have these great renewables here that we can really get on board with, but, like, there's also, yes, the element of danger that's associated with nuclear technology. I think you said something that is kind of the thing that sticks with me too, which is they said this couldn't happen.
Right.
And it's not that I don't trust scientists. I trust scientists more than just about anybody else on this planet.
Right.
The problem is that scientists don't know everything.
Right.
And so when we're messing with these forces, there may be something that they overlook.
Right.
So, and in this case, it was, oh, well, you know, the reactor couldn't possibly explode. That's just not a thing that can happen. And you see Jared Harris in this episode when he's confronted with the question, how does this RKM or RMK reactor explode? He goes, well, I'm not prepared to answer that.
Right. It's a good scientist answer.
Yes, that's the best scientist answer, is I don't know. So, like, to say, okay, well, we're, you know, 50 years on from this or whatever, 30 years on from this, and we've got better technologies, and we have fail-safes installed. Yes, and I think those are all great things, but how sure are we about those?
Right. And, you know, also you got to weigh that against, it seems like, the near scientific certainty that we are going to disrupt millions and millions, if not tens and hundreds of millions of people over the next few decades of global warming. It's like,
which is worse. Yeah.
Very tough choices. And there's probably not a completely safe, it seems like most people say we're beyond the point of like safe, inexpensive, easy fixes to these problems. Everything we're going to choose is going to be fraught with peril, potential political instability and economic devastation. Because that's the thing. Like, I didn't know that Chernobyl could go as bad as it could have done. Like, they were 48 hours away. Yeah. And if not for the scientists stepping forward and saying, the solution you guys are doing, you guys aren't thinking through all the variables. Because it's weird. It's one of those things where it's like scientists got us into this situation, but scientists also got us out of it.
They're the only ones who can get us out of it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me that this character, Yulana, I think is her name, played by Emily Watson, is kind of an amalgamation, from what I've heard, of not just like a single... She's not a real character, but she's sort of an amalgamation of like hundreds of scientists who came together and noticed these problems and said, we need to come up with these solutions and help fix it all.
Yeah, I mean, it's... You hate when they have to make concessions to Hollywood, but as they were explaining, it's like, you know, if you had literally hundreds of scientists working together, both officially, unofficial, on the record, off the record, and formally, and all contributing little things about, oh, don't forget about this, don't do this, like, oh, what about this research, what about our reading, say this, like, how do you do that in a five-hour miniseries? Well, the answer is you unrealistically collapse them down into one single person. Now, the worry I had when I found them saying that in the like on the podcast I listened to and on the behind the episode is that it might make Emily Watson seem like a crazy know-it-all.
Yeah.
Because like I like that part too. Like after the first episode, I was thinking Jared Harris is just a fucking man. You know, this Legolas that he's just like, you know, he is an expert and he knows the stuff and he's going to steer this ship. But like, it just goes to show that even a very smart person without accurate information is not always correct. Also, something I learned in a podcast, the writer of this Chernobyl series said that Legolov was not actually an expert on these RMBK reactors. He worked at this very prestigious nuclear facility institute and was a qualified physicist, but his background was much more in like chemistry. So like, you know,
okay. So he understands the concepts behind it, but he's not familiar with like the engineering part of it.
I'm trying to think. It's like, it's more of like, it's kind of like if a mechanic is billed as an expert in Corvette engines, but he's actually just a mechanic.
Sure.
You know, like he's familiar with the principles, engines, but he doesn't know the ins and outs and intimate details of like the actual power plant and things like that. And I don't know whether the series itself, I don't feel like has done a good job showing whether this was just a mistake that the Russians made of like, well, this guy's the head of this particular nuclear institute, so he must be, or maybe he wrote a paper on it one time, or whether, you know, he saw he was the only guy in the room that was even remotely qualified to talk about it and overstate his credentials just to, they don't really say that. In fact, the only way I know this is because of the damn podcast. So
yeah, it doesn't seem like they wanted to really anything from him other than, you know, this technical input.
Yeah.
They didn't want to hear, oh, well, here are the nuances of what I know and, yeah. and versus what we need to know here. But it's interesting to me, like, I came away from the first episode going, oh my God, the denial that these people are in, these fools, this 3.6 reading makes no sense if you mm-hmm. just take a second and look at it. Mm-hmm. But then you have Jared Harris who comes in and says, let's dump boron and sand on this thing.
Right.
And it turns out he fucked up. He didn't have all the information. He didn't right. know enough about the scenario to make the right call. I wonder if this is... So, you know, in a realistic scenario, I don't know how much they're embellishing here, but I wonder if the writers intended to make this point about how we should be more sympathetic to the people who made the original calls. Mm-hmm. Although I will say that Dyatnov is probably the most culpable in all this. And mm-hmm. I mean, the show says that right up front, right? Like right. he's the guy and right. Jared Harris blows his head off or hangs himself.
Uh-huh.
But it did make me step back and say, are these people to be looked at a little more sympathetically because they simply didn't have all the required knowledge or information in the moment?
Yeah, especially when you think about the time in the 1980s, how unsophisticated people's views on kind of technology were anyway. I mean, when I read articles, there's so much politics mixed up with it, as is anything. Plus, you know, like all art is political. You know, you're either maintaining the status quo or you're questioning it. Both of those things are intensely political, but it's hard not to, like, I see a lot, and there's some of this feedback we're going to be talking about, where, like, people, like, smugly assert that this couldn't happen in the United States because, you know, Soviet communism was this and that, and it caused this kind mm-hmm. of... But honestly, when I go through this and see, like, I think they happen for different reasons, but things happen very similarly. Like... The speech that this guy played by Stellan Skarsgård gives to kind of motivate the volunteers to go into a doomsday, it's not the same that like an American no. politician would give, but the message is the same.
Yeah,
like
sacrifice.
Who is the one willing to trade their life for millions of people? That is something that appeals to almost every person. That doesn't appeal to everyone. But it's like if you give that speech to a room full of 100 people, you're going to get your volunteers.
Yeah, I mean, the military is essentially predicated on that whole idea, right?
Yeah.
The fact that we have someone who's willing to pick up a gun and go fight to protect, you know, the freedoms
and
that,
then it's
that we
very,
have.
And it's also like, you know, people are like, oh, look how close-minded and pig-headed these people are. But like also I think it did a good job of like if you can convince, like if you can get through – anyone's political apathy to like make them realize this is a fucking critical threat right now. Like when Jared Harris grabs a pilot and says, if you fly over this reactor, I guarantee yeah. in 24 hours, you will be praying for the bullet this guy's threatening you with. And I see that in American culture too. Like we get politically complacent and we don't want to deal with the repercussions of the way we vote and how that impacts the world. And then when things blow up on our face, we want to be like, woe is me. But when it seems like time and time again, when the chips are down and when you got life and death that people do type pitch together. And, you know, I'm like, because it's funny because I woke up this morning and I did this thing I always do. I was reading the front page of Reddit. And one of the articles bubbled my attention is the fact that there are now something like 37,000 open cases from 9/11 first responders and people affected in those blocks of New York City that are having like way crazy elevated rates of like cancer and other medical conditions involving the toxic chemicals and the construction materials that they breathed in. We sent in hundreds and thousands of people in there to do whatever it took to put out those fires, to rescue people. We didn't ask, like, what are they bathing in? What are they breathing in? Is this adequate yeah. safety? And it's kind of a semi-scandal that here's the American political reaction to this. I'm gonna simulate it for you. Pretend that I am actually walking past a literal graveyard. That's what the American political response is to this disaster
uh-huh.
in a capitalist democratic society. I think it's way. I just think it's this way too smug and self-serving to be like, oh, these fucking Russians.
Sure.
What they're con. Their society had unique problems and challenges and also advantages and disadvantages, just like our society would have dealing with a similar thing.
Yeah.
So I like that. Like, I don't think our politicians would threaten to throw someone from a helicopter for disobeying them. I don't know. Maybe a few of them would.
I've seen a few Tom Clancy shows. Yeah. It might happen.
But like this, like pig, like there's this one bureaucrat who, like, the scientist says, I'm a scientist. You're a shoe factory manager. And he goes, yeah, and I'm the one in charge. Fuck off.
That's so American. That's so fucking American.
I literally see people say that to scientists all the time about things that they think they know more about. So it's like, it really bothers me when people are so smug and dismissive about the problems in our own society and, like, heap scoring upon ones and the other. But we'll get to that in feedback.
It's Jared Harris time, baby. Jared Harris time. Finally. It took one full episode to get to him, but we've got him now.
Yeah.
Don't let go.
Yeah. I thought so the interesting thing about this is I wonder how important was Jared Harris blowing this alarm at the time he did, because it does feel like that this, unlike many, many other tragedies that a nation could cover up, is maybe the first of its kind where you can literally see the disaster from space. Like a Swedish scientist, I guess what happened is, like, a Swedish worker at a power plant was coming in, like, the first guy of his shift. He walked in through the radiation detector and it blared because he just came in from outside. And, like, what the fuck?
So very much like this, where they open the window and go, oh, shit.
It's not like the CIA or MI6 was running their nuclear detectors and, like, oh, my God. So it's like literally a civilian, like, noticed, Jesus Christ, what's up with all this radiation? I guess one of the things is a lot of these radioactive isotopes have, like, almost fingerprints. So you can tell, like, what stock of uranium it came from, what plant, sometimes even what reactor. And they're able to quickly, oh, this is Chernobyl. It's fucking blown up.
Yeah.
So, like, Jared Harris might have gotten the Soviets going, like, 12 to 24 hours earlier, but it also doesn't seem like it made his contributions, maybe in the grand scheme of things, are going to make that much of a difference.
Well, I think the most important part of Jared Harris's alarm here is that he's the guy that they brought in. Because I think the resistance to believing these outsiders about, oh, really, you're 400 kilometers away and you say this is a problem. Sure, we got this.
And you could see them maybe like, oh, they're making German children play inside. Well, that's just to embarrass us.
Yeah.
Like, they know that it's safe, but they want to, their fucking capitalist dog media is wanting to rake us over to coals.
Right. But him, you know, him being the guy that they brought in to tell them, and then having Gorbachev here. Who seemed to be pretty rational about the whole thing, right? You saw Stellan Skarsgård, whose character's name I don't know. He was kind of ready to blow Jared Harris off. But luckily, there was enough force put into the thing that he had to say that he got the attention of the general secretary there.
Yeah, this guy is Brezhnev, or I think it's something like that, the Stellan Skarsgård character. Seemed like he's going to be in the mold of those pig-headed bureaucrats, but, like, it does seem like he's got enough sense about him that once you penetrated that, he actually is a pretty... he seems like he might be the right guy to lead, because I was very impressed with his speech to, like, to motivate the people to solve this reactor water problem. There's a lot of individual heroics. Like, I thought when they had the... Like the brigadier general or whatever, who's from the decontamination team, and he finds out that they want to run in there with, like, a, you know, get a dosimeter from the heart of the reactor. And Jared Harris is like, even with all the lead shielding, might not be enough. And he's like, okay, then I'll do it.
Yeah, rather than order one. That's heroism.
It's fucking heroism and patriotism, and something that I found pretty moving. That you know, like you like, in contrast to all these other, like, party apparatchik guys that are trying to pass the buck, like, this guy, he knows the cost of lives. And something they made in the podcast is, you know, when Jared Harris asked, because to solve this problem of the reactor exploding with the force of 2 to 4 megatons, they're going to have to drain this water, and their men are going to have to wade waist high up in the radioactive water. And likely die if the radiation is as high as they fear. He's like, you know, we need your permission to Gorbachev, and makes it clear that we're ordering people to death. And I thought it was the writer in the podcast made it clear that he wanted to make sure that, I think a lot of people would assume that, like, the evil empire, as Ronald Reagan characterized the Soviet Union, would just be like, okay, fuck it. How many do you need? 3, 5, 100,000? How many lives do we need to pump in this to make it go away? But no, these, like, Gorbachev does seem like he was a pretty reasonable person who is a sober-minded civil servant. And those things weighed on him. Yeah. And I guess they had a policy throughout this crisis where they called counting lives, because many, many solutions are put on the table. And a lot of times going solution A or B, they literally like, well, this will work and it's going to make 5 people die, and this will work and it's going to make 20 people die. So I guess let's go with the 5 death.
Yeah.
And that was kind of like a bedrock principle of like, you know, people are going to die. Just like this is a war, you know, you got 3 billion trillion bullets being fired. People are going to die in this war. How can we minimize that? And also, you also have to strike a balance between the individual lives being utterly spent and millions of lives dying, or hundreds of thousands of people getting thyroid cancer. It's a real fucking philosophical and moral quandary to find yourself into.
On the topic of heroism and talking about, you know, the guy who drives the truck in, I thought they did a really excellent job of just sort of injecting every frame of that hosing down the truck scene.
Yeah.
With radiation. Like, I felt the radiation coming off this truck.
Yeah.
Which I guess I had been prepared for, because what I wasn't thinking about was sort of the clothing that the firefighters were wearing, the clothing that these responders were wearing, being contaminated to the point where you could get seriously ill just touching them or being close to them.
That's you can become irradiated to where a human body, a piece of clothing, a baby. Like, the one thing I thought starts when the man is desperately trying to get hand his baby across the hospital barrier. They're not allowed. Just like, just take my child and get him as far away from here as you can. Like, and of course that's delivered to a character who is currently carrying a baby inside her. I thought that shit was really powerful. And also the old doctor who's trying to treat these burns with like fucking witch doctor shit.
Yeah, milk and shit.
And that's another thing they made in the podcast is like, you know, the Soviet Union in the 80s, like most of the world, was not very progressive when it came to women in politics. But they were actually above average progressive in women being involved in like STEM and medicine. And they're showing that through the female scientist and the female doctor. Like, this female doctor could come up to this doctor and be like, you fool, stop dousing people with milk, get them naked, get all this clothes down to the basement. And the director of the series pointed out on the podcast that like in that hospital today is that same heap of clothes that was dumped in the basement and no one ever came back for.
Wow.
Like, that's like highly radioactive firefighting clothes down there.
Yeah. So, I mean, all those doctors are obviously heroes. They're sticking, you know, by their patients, and they're giving them the treatment they need despite what is obviously a detrimental thing for their health. And then this, we talked about Skarsgård's character, but the thing that struck me is that both he and Legasov understand that they are basically signing a contract for their own death here. Like, they, by sticking around this reactor, by helping to solve this problem, they themselves will be dead, as Jared Harris says, in 5 years.
And you can tell that's the first time the Skarsgård character, like, because
I mean, it knocks him to his ass.
We gotta get these people out of here. He's like, oh, okay, whatever, we're still here. He's like, yeah, and we're gonna be dead in 5 years.
Uh-huh. I love it because Jared Harris is this entire episode going around to people just telling them when they're going to die.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like you're fucked. Helicopter pilot, you're going to die in a day.
Yeah.
You, Stellan Skarsgård, 5 years max.
Yeah, yeah. This person's dead. These people are likely going to be dead in a week. You know? Yeah.
We need one of those internet, when am I going to die calculators with Jared Harris face on there. Just telling you, or tomorrow.
The Harris scale of how fucked you are. Right. Like, your death is immediate. Your death is in 24 hours and you'll be begging for death. Your death is, yeah. They told a story on the podcast just to give you an idea of how radioactive a person can become and still live. One of these plant engineers was like helping a guy who later dies, but he had inhaled this radioactive particulate from the reactor.
Oh, boy.
And when the guy got, like, he's, like, you know, leaning on him and he's trying to get him out of this hallway, when he finally got safe, there was later on this guy's back a burn imprint in the shape of a human arm and hand from how fucking radioactive the dude that he was carrying was. It's like...
Wow.
And it's like we were talking about in the first episode, I don't have a good idea of just how fucked everyone is. Like, there's 50,000 people. They evacuate a town of 50,000 in less than 24 hours.
Okay.
Took us 1,000 buses from the Kiev bus system, just convoyed them there, the police went around and said, grab, you're allowed one suitcase, you've got to leave now. And by all accounts, it was a fairly orderly, there's a really cool scene of like everybody getting on the buses, and you see the old fucker that said, this is going to be our moment to shine.
Yeah,
and,
is this guy busted down to just like a civvy now? Is he?
I don't know.
They just wake him up in his PJs? And
yeah, I wasn't sure what they were trying to say with that.
Because I would think he would not get out of there on a regular-ass bus. Like, right. He would be off on a helicopter or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, like, how, I mean, it was... You know, one of the problems of the Soviet Union, of course, is that it's supposedly workers' paradise where there's no class and everyone's equal. But turns out the people in power are driving limousines and having, you know, like eating off drinking out of crystal glasses and off fine china, like
getting the good caviar.
I mean, we've all read Animal Farm. Mm-hmm. I think we all know like what are the perverse incentives of society like that. I thought all that was really well done, and the fact that it kind of galvanizes this guy though, because when he's given that speech in front of, because people are like, why the fuck would we go in this reactor for 400 rubles, which I assume is like a pittance, and a promotion and a career at another reactor when we're probably going to die? And he's like, look, hey, I spit on the people that made this responsible, and I really trying to come to grips with what has already going to happen to me. But the fact is, what we're doing here is going to save millions of people's lives, and if that's not enough, then I won't believe it. And
yeah,
you know, they get their volunteers.
I think they did a really good job laying out how a nuclear reactor works. Like, I had read on Wikipedia, but. You know, reading it is one thing, having explained to you as if you're a layperson, which this guy was, it makes a lot of sense. And I liked the scenes where they sort of deconstructed what was wrong with the solution they had come up with. Because when they said, oh my God, the tanks are full, I'm like, so what?
Right.
Who the fuck cares about tanks? Like, I was Gorbachev, right? Asking the question.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, so they did a really good job explaining what a serious disaster that could be, because you think about like just the one reactor blowing up. Well, now you got three surrounding it, at least three.
Mm-hmm.
I assume reactor four is the last reactor.
Yeah, it is. There's no reason that should be true, but it actually happens to be.
Right. But then they could take out, it could cause a chain reaction. And unless you're Keanu Reeves on a moped, you're not getting out of that. They did a great job impressing upon me the scale of this disaster, which we talked about, but it just blew me away.
Do you know why? Like, one of the most gripping scenes I thought was when they're trying to drop this boron sand. In my previous reading on this, they mentioned that this was their initial attempt to put out the fire. And they mentioned, like, the book that I read made it seem like it was kind of like mysterious of why the accuracy was so bad in dumping the sand. But it seems now it's like the helicopter pilots were in this weird thing. It's like they had to like either, you know, swing it over before they released, or hope that the wind would carry. Because if you flew right over the reactor, it's not just a bad idea and like you're going to die in a couple of weeks, but it seems like it just disintegrated the helicopter from either the heat or the radiation. I'm not actually don't know what mechanically caused that helicopter to break up, but it did. So that explains like why the sand was having difficulty getting to the actual part of the fire they need to put it out. Those three guys that go in, I thought they did a great, like that last scene where their flashlights are failing one by one because of the intense radiation, and they're going to be chest deep in radioactive water, presumably in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, and with the Geiger counter motif going, like, so good.
Yeah, it does feel like that's just a thing for the show. I don't know what the point of even bringing a counter in there is.
Well, like, because,
you know, it's highly irradiated.
Right.
You know you're not going to live beyond a week or so past this. What are you even doing?
But I guess, like, if you can go down one hallway to get to the place you need to get, and it's like radiation level X, and then the other hallway's radiation's 10X, and like one you can survive for 5 minutes, the other you can survive for, like, that makes a big, like, I definitely think since this is a thing you can't see, you got to have a rate just so you know. You know,
at least the audience knows. I do think though that maybe that indicates what happened to the helicopter, because their lights start to go out, not not from any heat. Obviously, that would kill them first. But the electronics seem to fail based on, I assume, the radiation that's hitting them. Yeah. So maybe that's what happened to Helicopter 2. It was the radiation that took it out.
It's just radiation is such a weird thing because it's like, you know, like we talked about, it's these invisible bullets flying around. And we don't usually have a lot of experience of, like, what happens when matter is disrupted in that sort of way.
Yeah.
So, like, it kind of, like, you know, like an EMP, like, that's, like, the nuke part of a nuke without the thermal explosion can take out, like, we've seen it in how many different fucking shows. Like, it can take out a huge area of the electronics and... so it makes sense that, like, this is broad spectrum radiation. So, you know, I'm sure that ionizing radiation doesn't do anything good for circuit boards. It's so weird though, because I thought it's not like the plane just dropped, the helicopter dropped out of the sky, like the rotor started coming off and shit. And I know that, like, if you irradiate metal, it can make it brittle and it can do all other kinds of interesting properties. Did you know that, like, pre-1945 steel is, like, a precious commodity in the world? Because every steel made after the Hiroshima bomb has trace amounts of radiation. There's some applications where you cannot have any, like medical applications and, like, scientific instruments. And there's, like, finite, limited supply of steel made before that time, and we can never make it again. Because ever since Hiroshima and Nagasaki and all the fucking nuclear explosions that we did around the world in testing, like, there's enough background radiation that you can no longer make steel that's not radioactive.
Eh, Elon Musk will bring some back from space.
What a great profit motive. You need a moon base so you can just make steel, make pristine lunar steel or Martian steel.
Get some of that moon metal.
Anything else you want to talk about before we get to feedback? Because we got a decent amount of it. I am fully invested. This was an hour and 10 minutes, slightly longer, an hour episode, and I felt like it lasted 20 minutes.
Yeah, I would... If all of these episodes were available now, I would have binged them easily on that first night.
Yeah. Before we get to feedback, a few notes on housekeeping. Of course, we are currently being dominated by Game of Thrones stuff. That's all throughout baldmove.com. This Wednesday, in celebration of that, we have our Super Serious Film Fest Fantasy, which keeps rolling on. Excalibur comes out today on Wednesday, and you want to subscribe to the movies feed that contains that, because we're also going to be reviewing John Wick very early next week, John Wick 3 as well. Also tonight on twitch.tv/baldmove, Cecily and I are going to be co-oping some more Mario World 3D, and next Tuesday, immediately after our live recording Game of Thrones podcast, Jim and I are going to get on to Twitch to play some of the browser-based Game of Thrones game, Winter is Coming, and we're also going to broadcast some of our classic, Telltale, House Forester, the Game of Thrones game, which is pretty entertaining. And then Friday for Bald Move TV, we're going to be watching a few episodes, or an episode of Catch 22, the new show on Hulu starring George Clooney. And it's produced and directed by him as well, I believe. Fleabag on Amazon, that's season 2 of a returning show. And then the Muhammad Ali documentary, What's My Name, on HBO. That's all that's coming out here on baldmove.com. All right, first up, Alina. Very happy you're covering this series. It's a separate pod. I've been looking forward to it for a while. I grew up in a family where Chernobyl always existed as an event, quote-unquote, and I've seen many a documentary over the years. I'm guessing that maybe Alina's Eastern European, or perhaps Russian herself.
Could be.
I've seen many a documentary over the years. You'll probably get recommendations for the various BBC, Discovery, etc. documents, but I'd also like to add the following recommendations. Chernobyl Heart, a profoundly grim looking at the effects of the health of children born after Chernobyl. 1986.04.26.ps, which is a whole playlist from a project that used restored archive footage and interviews with liquidators, which is, I don't think they've got to this on the show, but I guess that's the Russian name for the people involving the containment and deactivation of this reactor. They called them all liquidators because their insides turned... No.
Oh, God.
I'll be going back to this a lot through the miniseries to compare set design, etc. It'll be really be interesting to see how certain things are recreated. For example, the cleanup of the graphite, the lead armor, etc. One thing we didn't talk about is... how it's already eerie that this town, once it's completely abandoned and you've got like Jared Harris and Skarsgård standing on top of the building and they just kind of look out, it's like, this, that's what the city looks like even today.
with like, a few more plants.
It has completely like, people boned out, 50,000 people boned off from that, and no one has returned. It's kind of creepy and amazing. Chernobyl 380 or 3828. This is in the above playlist, but especially interesting due to the narration. Some of the morbid slash pragmatic humor in the writing is a little lost in the subtitles. But it's still quite useful in creating an impression of how some people tried to cope with the circumstances they were in. For example, people would say they're going on a date with Masha, which meant cleaning up the Zone M, which was the more highly contaminated one. All of these recommendations I'm going to list in the show notes, so don't worry about looking it up. You just go to show notes and they'll all be linked there. Louis M., I haven't started Chernobyl, and I'm not sure I could stomach it, but I'm really interested in why it seems like the Soviets are more prone to this kind of disaster. I strongly recommend the American Experience documentary called Command and Control about a 1980s incident that almost resulted in the detonation of a Titan missile in Arkansas. This Titan missile is a six-story intercontinental ballistic nuclear missile. They seem to have no backup plans for this disaster. They lied to everybody about what was happening and simply got lucky with the result. This was a PBS documentary, which I'll link. Jared B. also said that there is a book called Command and Control by Eric Schlosser, which is essentially the book version of this the documentary. They just and this is like several, from what I could tell from reading the Wikipedia article, is it's a collection of several nuclear incidents or broken arrow type incidents where Americans have lost or damaged a nuclear device. And it's happened a lot more than I think we'd all be comfortable having active awareness of.
Yeah.
Our buddy Laura McPhee or Laura McPhee said, I wanted to point out a book that you might want to add to your reading list. And I've added it to my own, called Voices from Chernobyl, The Oral History of a Nuclear Disaster by Svetlana Alexievich, who is a Nobel laureate and who's living in Belarus when everything went down in Chernobyl. This was shouted out on the podcast because I guess this particular fireman and his wife that they're following, she has like a prominent chapter in this, and they essentially pulled her character entirely from that.
Huh.
Laura continues, Belarus, as you know, received the majority of the fallout after the explosion. She did interviews with people associated at different levels with the Chernobyl accident, including liquidators and her family members, civilians living in the area, etc. I'd also suggest, if you haven't seen it, White Light, Black Rain, The Destruction of Hiroshima, to see another story of a totally man-made horror story of nuclear destruction. Compelling, touching, intense, and important. Okay. So those were, had a call for Chernobyl, to see more stuff on Chernobyl, and that's what we got. The next three or so emails are people talking about the other thing we kind of pondered last week, which is, the socialism versus capitalism, democracy versus authoritarianism. Brian O. Starts off, Chernobyl is telling a cautionary tale of the dangers of too much socialism. The redefined word has seen a resurgence in popular opinion as it's changed from collection, ownership, and a planned economy to some sort of Robin Hood tale of what most market-based economies are today, which is the government redistributing an increasing portion of the country's wealth created by capitalism through social programs. There will be a desire by some to distance Soviet-style socialism from the modern definition they prefer, but I think that's wrong. The real conflict should be less about whether socialism is good or bad, but how much is too much? Chernobyl is an opportunity to tell the story of what socialism looks like with the volume turned at 100%. I'm looking forward to seeing our main characters represent heroic individualism in the face of a state that cannot abide dissent or freedom of thought, even if it means the death and destruction of their own people. So
after this episode, I'm falling less into that idea.
Yeah, and also, so like the problem with discussing socialism with Americans, when I found this in myself, because as people started talking more and more about socialism in the last few years, I've found myself forced to like, okay, actually find out about it. And I think that a lot of economics would take issue with the idea of Soviet Russia being 100% socialist. Just like if a Soviet would say, look at America's problems and it's the result of 100% capitalism. This is human nature, right? Like, I don't know how many conversations I've been in with conservatives and free market capitalists where they will insist that every problem with capitalism can be solved with just more capitalism. The problem with the capitalism is failing because government's intruding in it, or government regulation, or this or that.
Right.
I mean, I think it's I think it's obvious to anyone thinking that 100% of anything in any direction is probably wrong.
Yeah.
I think that as a individual private citizen in America, that like I think America is too reliant on capitalism and is resistant to try socialism in places where there's clear market failures, like in healthcare and public utilities and education, things like that. But I just saw a lot, like, this is a representative email. We'll have a couple others about people, like, I just don't know. Like, how the average American just doesn't know enough about the Soviet Union and socialism and communism to have a fair... It's like going to a Christian and asking them what's the problem with Islam, or going to an atheist and asking them what's the problem, what's the strengths and weaknesses of Christianity. Are they really going to be able to give a fair an accounting? Like, you have to kind of listen to the different sides and then kind of synthesize what you think is happening from all that. At least that's how I would view it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not educated enough on Soviet socialism to have any kind of opinion on this.
Yeah.
Honestly, like, I'm hoping that I will understand a little bit more about it by the end of this series, because I know that the writer has done a lot of research, not just on the event, but the society around this event.
Right. And I honestly would love, because this is something that I'm currently trying to think and grapple with myself, like, how much socialism is too much? What is socialism look like? Is, if socialism isn't right for the world now, will it, like, what will the effects of, like, if we had free and abundant energy provided by green sources and nuclear fusion, if we had advanced automation and AI where potentially 90% of the populace wouldn't have to work, would socialism be a good answer for that? How, and also something I think a lot of leftists should actually pay attention to is, when you set up a socialist society, how do you avoid it becoming like this? Where, like, preserving the party and preserving the workers and preserving becomes so important that you ignore actual facts. And I also think it's obviously, I think capitalists and democracies can ignore inconvenient facts just as well. Uh-huh. And that's the other thing, is just keep in mind that this, what you're trying to do is beat human nature. And, like, democracies have ways of beating human nature, and socialism and authoritarian and oligarchies, everyone has their ways, and they have strengths and weaknesses, and we really should be looking for best of breed solutions, I would think. But Chris J says, longtime listener, Bald Move Premium member, very glad you're discussing Chernobyl. I will try to save you a long and boring dissertation between the differences and advantages, both economic and moral, of a free market society over essentially controlled communist society. In the Soviet Union's communist economy, the people, i.e. the government, have an absolute monarchy across the society. This means they have control of the police, military, firefighters, and all the nuclear facilities. No competition within the power sector, which means no incentive to advance the technology and safety of their facilities.
Which I think is ironic, because what they were doing is trying to increase the safety of their facility.
Right.
Which caused this whole accident in the first place. So,
right. That's, yeah.
So if there's no incentive, why the hell would they do that?
Right. It's almost like they were trying to provide a good quality of life for the people as best as they could in the limitations of the form of government they had. Since the government owns the nuclear facility, police, and military, they can do things like cut off communication from the citizens and force scientists into extremely dangerous reactors, control the media, etc. Now think of a disaster in recent years in the United States, mostly free market society, the Deepwater Horizon spill. This was utter competence by BP, but the difference is they couldn't just throw human lives at the problem until it was fixed. Likewise, they couldn't just surround the coastlines with military and police and threatening people with silence.
I mean, there's only so many Mark Wahlbergs in this world.
Right. Also, people can choose now to get their gas from another organization or choose to forgo that type of power altogether. Yeah, I can choose not to use gasoline in America. BP is a single entity within our country, and while they certainly can cause damage due to incompetence, there are inherent checks and balances within the free market where a complete and dangerous monopoly reigns in communist or a socialist society. Interestingly, Carl S., without having any knowledge of Chris J.'s conversation, has the following to say. In the discussion about whether something like this could happen in the U.S., it got me thinking about an issue that hit close to my home. Thankfully, the scale of the disaster and the consequences to human life are not like Chernobyl, but the circumstances that led up to the tragedy and the failure of adequate response initially strike a similar chord to my ears. I live in southern Louisiana. In 2010, the Deepwater Horizon well blew up after bosses at BP and on the platform skirted safety regulations and ignored many signs of trouble. The rig blew up, people died, and oil started spewing into the Gulf of Mexico. Aaron mentioned Chernobyl being an entirely man-made event and how rare that seems to be, but the Deepwater Horizon strategy or tragedy is very similar. There's no weather or seismic issue that caused the blowout. It was just totally man-made and couldn't have happened on its own. And the similarities don't stop there. Initially, the government and BP were in denial about the flow rate of the petroleum leaking out of the earth, minimizing the scope of the event. Local seafood producers, along with our state leaders in Louisiana, reassured consumers that the food was perfectly safe to eat and we shouldn't be worried. Within days of the event, as the federal government moved to increase regulations and suspend drilling on deep water platforms in the Gulf, our state leaders got together to have a rally for economic security that is basically a big protest against regulating oil and gas companies at all, out of supposed concern that regulation would hurt our state economy. The rally also framed the oil industry as saviors of the state of Louisiana for all the jobs and wealth it produces, and the people around here continue to treat the oil industry as some kind of powerful but sort of uncaring god. The U.S. economy was still in a crisis then, and there was high unemployment, so there was a lot of temporary workers involved in cleanup work that were exposed to dangerous chemicals without health guidance. They took jobs not out of loyalty or patriotism to their country, but coerced essentially out of economic circumstances to the detriment of their health. I think this is what I'm saying is... Mm-hmm. It's very easy to look at the Soviet Union and look at all the problems and be like, oh, well, people were forced and coerced and all that, but ignore the fact that if you are living in a state that has very few economic options and there is a disaster like this and they're paying a whole bunch of temp workers and they say, jump in here and start scrubbing pelicans with this surfactant and disperse this shit in the water, you just do it. You know, you don't wait for scientific consensus. You don't wait to hear. And I again, like, I just felt like it was the previous guy, not to pick on you, Chris, but it's a little glib about how, like, oh, look at BP and it worked and we had our media covering it and the government had adequate response and people can go to other gas stations besides BP. That's all true, but how much of it's actually happening? You know?
Yeah.
Like, how much, like, what are the fictions that we tell ourselves about our society and the way we organize it? And what are the fictions that the Soviet told themselves about their society and how they organize it? And what does that look like when the rubber meets the road? I like to have a discussion about that. I don't want to have a whole bunch of people that haven't thought about this issue for more than 5 fucking minutes emailing me. And I'm not going to read as things that strike me as flippant or non-serious approaches to this, but I just want to say that, like, I do think these are conversations that are very important to us to have. These are conversations I think this show is kind of begging us to have. So let's do it. And you can send those takes to tv@baldmove.com. Please, any takes you have on Chernobyl, other disasters stuff. I'm in the mood to read and think about this stuff. tv@baldmove.com. We'll be back next week with episode 3. Really digging this series. Thanks for all the great feedback, and we'll see you guys then.